Howard Johnson organized the band for the television series Saturday Night Live. He played in the Saturday Night Live band from 1975 to 1980 and led the band during his last season with the show. For the past 3 years, he has received the National Association of Recording Arts and Sciences Most Valuable Tuba Player Award. Howard Johnson will be the guest artist this Monday evening at Philadelphia College of Performing Arts. The college will also feature PCPA students in jazz ensembles led by Evan Solot and Bill Zaccagni. Admission to this concert is free on a first-come, first-served basis, so that's Howard Johnson in concert at 8 o'clock, along with ensembles of Philadelphia College of Performing Arts students. The concert will be at the Schubert Theater Monday at 8. Before we hear from Howard Johnson, let's listen to a session he recorded with his own band, Gravity, which features 6 tuba players and a rhythm section. This is Be No Evil. Tuba player, composer, and arranger Howard Johnson and his band Gravity. Howard Johnson was born in Montgomery, Alabama, and after the age of 2 grew up in Massillon, Ohio. He moved to New York in 1963 after serving 4 years in the Navy, and he currently lives in Woodstock, New York. I spoke with him last week, and he told me why he wanted to play the tuba when he was young.
I guess when I was in the 7th grade, I joined the junior high school band as a percussionist. I was a terrible percussionist. I could never... You know, I could read all right, but I just really couldn't execute with my hands, you know. So I clanged around on the cymbals a lot. And I always watched the tuba players, you know, because I liked the instrument. I didn't think of playing it until the end of the 9th grade, when after which I'd already been playing baritone sax a year. My band director definitely didn't need me in the percussion section. So he showed me a couple of scales on the baritone sax, and then his schedule changed. So I had to learn it by myself pretty much, and in fact, entirely. And then the next year, just because of the similarity in the parts in a concert band of the baritone sax and the tuba, I became interested in the tuba fingering. I started playing it from there, you know. I didn't have instructions on that either, you know. And I was going to the high school. Our high school band didn't use the baritone sax, and I really couldn't play alto or tenor at that time. And they needed tuba players, and they were going to go on an important trip to the Tournament of Roses parade. We were from Ohio, from Massillon, Ohio, and so for high school kids, a trip to California in 1956 was pretty exciting.
So that's how you started. What attracted you about the instrument? It's really not a very popular instrument in a lot of ways.
Well, what it is I've always been attracted to low notes. You know, my earliest memories of records, it's the bass I listen to, the bass roll, the bass voice, the Baptist church choir. The bass voice is always favored. It was suggested before that's a cultural thing among black people, since it's kind of hard to call you boy if you got a bass voice, you know. When I was growing up in the South, there were actual incidences where you could get into trouble if you spoke too low to white people, you know.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people say, "Don't be basing it me, boy."
Huh.
You know, like, you know, if you speak, you know, as a man, you know, man to man, it was too upsetting to them. So as a result, I think culturally there is a kind of connection to lower pitched voices and lower pitched instruments among black people in general. And that's why the role of the baritone sax developed in Duke's band the way it did, with a powerful player like Harry Carney. And if you really check it out, it's really the foundation of all black music.
Did you feel that the tuba gave you that kind of authority when you started playing it?
Oh yeah. I had everything connected just like that. I mean, if you see what I play, it's all low. You know, the clarinets that I play are low, the saxophones I play are low, and play electric bass and, tuba. And that's just kind of where I hear myself. The tuba, I always liked the sound of it, you know. I mean, it's just been played badly, you know. It's the only reason it has the bad rap that it does, you know. And when it's played badly, it's not written for imaginatively. And then you know, the requirements to play the instrument according to what's already written, you know, just stay at the level where the player's deficiencies were. But in the last 20 years, 25, say, you know, there have been a lot of new players, both in classical and in jazz, you know, who just haven't accepted the limitations of the already written music, you know, and they've inspired new music to be written. And, of course, in jazz, you know, a person can use all the ability that they have in their own expression, you know. So, and I didn't set out to be a jazz tuba player, you know. I wanted to play the tuba, and I wanted to play jazz. And, you know, I just wanted to play jazz on the instruments that I played. And I never thought, you know, that I couldn't do it or anything like that. You know, it's and not having any teachers probably helped a lot with that too, because I didn't get their sense of the limitations either. You know, they didn't tell me what was hard or what was impossible or what I shouldn't even try. You know, because after I'd been playing tuba about a year and I started getting serious about playing, and I started talking to teachers, and they were all telling me that I couldn't do what I was already doing. And they also said that I shouldn't do it. For instance, I had a high range, you know. I could play F in the staff on the treble clef. And they said, well, that's too high. Well, too high for what, you know? You know, I mean, if I was in the 10th grade and I could do that, and if I played jazz, I could use it, you know, that and more. But, you know, they had a real sense of limitations that I just didn't have.
Was it hard to find bands that you could play jazz with, since jazz bands had long before been using basses to play the bass part? And I'm sure there was very little precedent at that time for tubas and small bands.
From the time I got out of high school to my first year in New York, I didn't have an instrument, you know, because when I was in high school, I used school instruments, you know, and so I didn't play for 5 years. I was in the Navy, and I had a baritone sax, but I didn't have a tuba. So when I got a tuba, I was already in New York and semi-established on the scene there as a baritone sax player. So what I would do then is just go around and sit in at jam sessions, you know, just to get the idea in people's heads that it was happening. And that wasn't particularly easy because people don't think in those terms, you know. They couldn't at the time figure out what could a tuba possibly do in a small band setting, you know. And but I was prepared. I was came to New York to play jazz, you know, basically, you know, and so I knew all the tunes, I knew all the changes, you know, but I had a hard time getting to play a lot of times because they were certain it just wasn't going to be any good at all, you know. And I never really had much trouble after I played, you know, but sometimes there was a lot of resistance to me playing in the first place, you know.
We said that a lot of musicians couldn't figure out what it is a tuba could do in a small group setting. Yeah. What kinds of parts did you create for yourself? Were you playing the bass line or doing something different?
No. If there's a jam session scene, you know, the people play, you know, some of those bird tunes or something like that, you just play them together, you know. I just play it in the ensemble with everybody else, you know. I don't ask less of myself than any other instrumentalist at all, you know. I mean, and that's one of the reason I'm bringing that up is that there are getting to be more tuba players coming around who are trying to play, but they always set up situations where they don't really have to deal, you know. They don't really have to be just as well developed a jazz player as, say, a trumpet player or even a saxophone player, you know. They say, well, okay, I'll put myself in this setting, and the piano will take most of the solos, and I'll just maybe do a little scalar stuff through here. But, you know, when it comes to playing jazz, you know, they're like maybe five or six nationwide, you know, who are ready to just stand up and, you know, blow on any tune anytime, you know.
It's a difficult instrument to get around quickly, isn't it? I mean, can you play a very fast lick easily on the tuba?
Oh, absolutely. What it is, I mean, the compensations have to be made. You know, for instance, the valve stroke, the distance of that you have to push down the valves is much longer than, say, a trumpet. And it's heavier than a trumpet valve, you know. But if you watch a trumpet player, you'll see his fingers moving from his knuckles out, you know, and that's how he's able to play as fast as he is. Well, if I want to play as fast as a trumpet player, I have to use not only my knuckles but my wrist and all the way down to my elbow, so that I'm actually maybe fanning the valves, you know. And you know, students of physics can see that that's a more sophisticated leverage system than just from the knuckles out, which is already pretty sophisticated with those three joints on the fingers, you know. But then you add to that the between the knuckles and the wrist and the elbow, and you know, it quite simply compensates, you know. There's when it comes to playing fast, it can play as fast as anybody.
The lips are different too. Don't you have to make more major changes in your embouchure in order to change notes more so than you would in a trumpet, for instance?
Well, yeah, if you're comparing it to trumpet, but why compare it to trumpet? You know, it's got to be approached as itself, you know, and you don't do remotely the same things, you know. I mean, the instrument is two times longer in length than the trumpet, but the mouthpiece is about six times in volume. You know, the cup of the mouthpiece, maybe even more than that. And I don't think of it in terms of adjustments. You know, I would think of it in terms of adjustments if I compared it to the trumpet. But you know, it's just its own entity. You know, you do what you do for it.
Have you ever studied breathing, taken certain breathing lessons, or do breathing exercises?
No, I'll tell you, just about everything that I have developed technically comes from just the need to do what I need to do to express myself, you know. Now, what I demand of myself in an improvising situation is a good deal more than almost any, say, written situation. So I'm covered with conventional technique just because I've asked that much of myself and a good deal that they haven't asked of me.
That's tuba player and baritone saxophonist Howard Johnson, and we'll be hearing more from him in just a moment on Fresh Air. Let's hear an example of his work with a jazz band led by trombonist Roswell Rudd. This was recorded in 1973 from the Pneumatic Swing Band album. This was a piece written for Howard Johnson. It's called Breath of Howard. Howard Johnson featured on tuba. The piece was called Breath of Howard, and it's featured on the trombonist Roswell Rudd record, The Pneumatic Swing Band. He told me how he and his tuba started to break into jazz circles.
For me personally, I never really had much difficulty after being heard. You know, I think there are a couple of other players who feel that way too. But writers were using the instrument very well in the 50s. They kind of discovered the instrument then. Now, as it turned out then, what they could hear was a good deal more than a lot of the players who were available at that time could do, you know. They were writing things that the players were saying, well, you shouldn't write that for the tuba and everything, you know. And it was very good tuba writing, beyond what the players could do. So when I came to New York, I looked up some of those people, you know, and they said, some of them said, oh, I don't really use the tuba anymore, you know, giving it every chance with the best players here and everything, and, you know, kind of moaning about it, you know. So I made an effort to get heard by these folks and ended up working with some of them, Gil Evans, Oliver Nelson, Quincy Jones, Ernie Wilkins. And of course, starting in 64, I started with Charles Mingus. And he and Gil Evans actually stretched me. Like, usually when a writer would call, he'd say, well, I have this idea. You see, the tuba can double the bass line, or the tuba can do, you know, it would always be something so simple to me, but a real stretch, or so simple to a tuba player, but a real stretch of his imagination, you know. But Gil Evans and Charles Mingus did ask things of me that I hadn't ever done before. I used to get calls from Mingus every day when I was in his band, and he had a speakerphone, a crude early speakerphone, where he'd put the phone in his cradle. And then he'd go across the room to the piano and say, can you play this? And he'd play something on the piano, you know. And I'd say, well, yeah, I think so. You know, I hadn't tried it before. But I said, you know, just write. I'd tell him, just write anything you want. You know, just anything you think it sounds like. Because you got a view of it that I don't have, you know. And I learned from that. But he would still call, you know. And because the phone was across the room, he would yell really loud, you know. Although, you know, the speakerphone had an amplifier, didn't really need that. And he would say, "Hey, can you play this?" And I'd be holding my ears.
could you sing one of the lines that he wrote that he thought would be very challenging, but that worked really well into the piece?
Can I sing one?
Yeah.
Oh, gee. I'll tell you what, that band never officially recorded that I was with, but it was a very unusual band of Mingus's, and there's a limited edition album of that music coming out that we recorded at a UCLA concert in 1965. Also, wait a minute, also on the Mingus's Let My Children Hear Music album, there's one called The Clown's Afraid Too, and The Eye of Hurricane Sue. Those two were orchestra arrangements of things we played in that band. But I don't know. Oh, yeah. He would do like, you know, like just having that kind of phrasing would be not what I mean. If you did that for regular symphonic tuba player, he'd say do di do di do di da, you know. but he would write things that were supposed to have a, you know, that kind of phrasing and very high things. On his there's some good writing by Bob Hammer on his album called Mingus 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 that has some very good tuba parts played by Don Butterfield. That even though Hammer did the arrangements, though, those tuba lines are actually his lines, you know. And he has the tuba singing up, you know, when there's long chords being held, he has the tuba singing up through the chords because he's got like the bass trombone and the baritone sax covering the low notes. And I really like that kind of thing. When I joined Mingus in 64, we played that music from that album, and also the music that he'd just come back triumphantly from Monterey, And his Mingus at Monterey album, the music he did there, he wanted to do in New York at Birdland. Red Calendar was supposed to come out and play the tuba because he'd played it in Monterey. But he got studio commitments and couldn't come. And I wandered into the Five Spot one night, and Jackie Byard suggested, well, here's your tuba player, you see. And that's actually how I got into the band at all.
If you're just joining us, my guest is tuba player Howard Johnson, who's featured on many jazz and rock recordings, and is the former leader of the Saturday Night Live band. Have you ever done any symphonic work?
Not really. There used to be an orchestra that I would rehearse with called the Harlem Youth Orchestra. In fact, I actually did a few concerts with them. And last year, in the early part of last year, I did a concert with Jean-Pierre Rampal, although it was Scott Joplin rags. It was the flute, the piano. Buddy Williams played drums, and I played the tuba at Avery Fisher Hall. And although it was ragtime part, kind of oompa parts, really, you really had to employ that kind of, the classical kind of touch to it. You know, I remember, I don't ever remember playing so soft in my life and having it heard all throughout Avery Fisher, you know, because they got good acoustics in there. But the one place where there came to like a fortissimo, that was the softest fortissimo I ever heard, you know, but it required a very light and kind of pure sound.
Are oompa parts the bane of a tuba player's existence?
No. As a matter of fact, even in traditional jazz, everybody wants to use the bass because of the four-beat playing, you know. And so two-beat is kind of dying out, you know. I like to kind of be a person that still plays the old two-beat thing, you know. I do that whenever I can, you know, whenever I get the opportunity. Because I do get those calls every now and then, you know. It's funny, they call me and they're like apologetic, you know, and they say, well, this is only going to be Dixieland now. I say, hey, wait a minute, you know. It's all right with me.
How did you start playing in rock bands?
Well, my very first experience as a professional musician was with my sister, who used to be what was called in the 50s an exotic dancer. That's somebody who dances in a very brief costume, like a stripper does. Only they can really dance. You know, it isn't just jiggle time. You know, so she would sometimes book herself at maybe four or five dances on an evening, and I would come in with her with my baritone sax at the age of about 15 or so, and talk the band into her show. You know, tell them what happens next, what kind of thing to play, give the drummer the tempo. You know, because she does a long thing with just the drums, and then the band comes in. And then while she was getting dressed, I'd be maybe jamming on a couple of tunes with the guys, and then we'd take off for the next one, you know. And this was just about entirely rhythm and blues, rock and roll scene. So I've always known the music. I mean, in the 50s, you weren't considered a saxophone player if you couldn't play Honky Tonk, you know, the Bill Doggett old hit, you know. And so as the music developed over the years, I just kind of stayed with it. I played with King Curtis in 1965 and got connected with the soul recording scene at that time, you know, and did a lot of dates like that on baritone sax. So that just kind of progressed. I guess that went over to the rock scene in about 1970 with Taj Mahal. We did that band with Taj Mahal that did that album, The Real Thing, live at the Fillmore East in 71. And later on in that year, I did Rock of Ages with the band, or at the end of the year, 71, 72. And so it's just some more music, you know. I never had the sense that I never had the sense that there was any kind of music that's not as good as some other, you know. There's no bad music. There's some bad playing.
Yes.
But if I could see myself in it, I would do it. You know, at the same time, I didn't do things just to have a gig. You know, I don't seem to do that too well. I mean, I know it sounds impractical, but it's not really because I don't function well in supposedly musical situations where I'm unhappy, you know. So,
have you turned down gigs?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I had to bail out of I'd heard that a guy was going to ask me to go with the Rolling Stones, whom I don't care for at all, you know. And I called a guy and asked him to don't ask me.
You're probably one of the few musicians who would do that, right?
I don't know. I mean, when I talk to people about it, you know, people who, you know, in every way that I know of have what I'd call integrity, you know, they say, you should have taken it, you know. I'd have taken it, you know. Well, you know, I mean, I did stuff with John Lennon, you know. I loved doing that, you know.
What did he have you do?
I actually came in to do just to play on the Walls and Bridges sessions, his album Walls and Bridges. And there weren't any arrangements, and there was an atmosphere in the studio where nobody wanted to be the one to say, why don't we do this, you know. John himself had ideas, but he had this kind of thing of he thought of horn players as real musicians as opposed to rock and roll players, you know, and he was kind of shy of really communicating what he wanted, you know, and so what I did was I decided, well, maybe we'll, you know, let's try this or let's try that, you know. And none of that stuff ever got written down. It was all done on you play this and I'll play that and he'll play that, and I ended up being the arranger for the whole. I did all the horns for the album. I didn't do the rhythm section or the strings. In fact, we played two rhythm section tape, you know, and somebody put the strings on afterwards. Lennon had these wonderful ideas about things that he just didn't trust that well, you know, and in the last three or so arrangements, I worked very closely with him, and his ideas, you know, are what really made it happen. I felt, you know, I just kind of, you know, filled some of them out, you know.
You did an album with Yoko Ono too, right?
Yeah, I did a Season of Glass, and I think on the current Lennon and Ono album, I think another session that I did showed up on that as a song of Yoko's. I haven't really heard the album, but I think I'm playing a baritone sax solo on something on that album, Milk and Honey.
Did you work directly with her?
Oh yeah, for those sessions, it wasn't like horn section sessions. It was just me, really, and she would be, she was in the booth, but not recording, but just kind of talking to me during the recording. And I guess on the Season of Glass album, what I did mostly was kind of these screaming tuba things, you know. If you hear it, you might not know it's a tuba at all, you know. It's just kind of overblown and everything.
That's jazz and rock tuba player Howard Johnson. And in a moment, we'll talk about his work with the Saturday Night Live band, which he organized, played in, and eventually led. But first, let's listen to another rock session that he recorded from the album Rock of Ages by the band. This is Rag Mama Rag, with Howard Johnson featured on tuba. The band in concert from the album Rock of Ages, and that was Howard Johnson featured on tuba. He told me about his experiences with the Saturday Night Live band.
I went there in 1975, and I was the leader in the last season that I was there, 79, 80.
How did you get into the band? 75 was the first year, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so how did that happen?
Hard as it is to believe, that was 9 years ago, folks. Actually, because I'd done some work with Jeff Muldaur as an arranger, his producer, Joe Boyd, was a friend of Lorne Michaels. And Lorne was telling me that they had this band they were going to put together, and he had brought his own man to lead the band and be musical director, Howard Shore, down from Toronto. But they didn't really know New York musicians, so they needed someone to contract the band, you know, and hire the musicians. And Joe suggested me for, you know, putting together bands, because he knew I organized the horn section for Rock of Ages and Taj Mahal, and the sessions that I did. He liked the personnel that I picked for the sessions I did for Jeff. So he suggested me. Lorne told that to Howard, and Howard agreed because apparently that first month or so that I was with Mingus, when we went up to, in November of 64, when we went up to Canada to do a show on CBC, Howard Shore was like a high school guy, and he heard that, and he kind of remembered me from then. So they all approved that, and I put together the band. I actually almost ended up not doing that one too, because I told Howard when he first talked to me about it, I would give him some names, but I didn't really want to play because I didn't want to get tied down to a studio situation and or be in some kind of network-generated sense of what the music should be.
Do you think it would be like the Merv Griffin band?
Yeah, something like that, you know. And he said, well, if you feel that way, then you're definitely the man for us because we don't want a band like that. We want this to be the best band on television, you know, which isn't that hard to do, but it was.
Was it fun being in the band? I think that, like, during rehearsals, for instance, that the actors might have really played to the band.
Oh yeah, there was a lot of hanging out with the band, especially in our dressing room. The band's dressing room was referred to as the departure lounge. You see, I can refer to that because I was one of four in the band who did not do any drugs, But the cast would come up there and hang out a little bit, but they couldn't hang with the band too much because they had to be more together than that, you know. I think if they had cameras just following the band around, you know, they could have made a show out of that, you know. I mean, you should have seen that dressing room when we're all putting on our nurse uniforms, you know.
Nurse? Oh, right.
Yeah.
I think I saw that.
Boy, that was some laughs. That was more laughs than the bit we did on camera.
What were some of the other things you were called on to do that were unusual?
Well, I think we were bees once, and angels, and I used to get little parts in skits. Since I'm bigger and more dangerous looking than Garrett Morris, I'd be the big scary black guy, you know. And I also one time did a bit with the, you know, tuxedo and wig on as none other than Barry White.
Oh, great. I think I saw that too.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was like there was always some really pretty interesting stuff going on there. I mean, that was a good gig. I would have kicked myself if I'd turned that down.
Did you
being Mr. Integrity and everything, you know?
Did you leave when the new cast took over?
Yes, I was talking to them in the summer, and I wasn't sure if I was going to have a role in the new show or not, but I did do. And when the show came back on, I was busy doing Paul Simon's tour. Paul Simon did that world tour when his movie got released. And, world, I mean, U.S. and Europe.
So so you left to do that tour?
Yeah, and I didn't get back until November or something like that. So they were already going. But I was just as glad to leave then.
What do you think of the band on the David Letterman show?
Oh, those are all great guys. I don't know. I don't know quite what they're trying to do. Sometime I think they like to do covers of known rock and roll things, you know. And I just look at those great players, you know, guys that I know and have played with, and know how great they can play, and think, oh, gee. Getting kind of corporate sounding to me, but they're all great players. Paul Schaefer, I'm telling you, can play anything. You know, I've used him in my band Gravity, and I've had him play gospel piano. He can handle that. He can handle, you know, like Jimmy Smith type B3 organ. You know, that really arpeggiated kind of stuff that Pharoah Sanders plays. I mean, the guy can play that. You know. And all straight ahead jazz, all kinds of rock and roll, and that's not bad for a Jewish kid from Thunder Bay, Ontario. You know,
that's right near Buffalo.
No,
Thunder Bay, isn't it?
No, it's it's up off Lake Erie, I think. You know, it's much more obscure than that. You know, and I don't know what he heard up there, but he's really got it all. You know, he's great. keyboard player.
What do you think about when you listen to the Johnny Carson band on the Tonight Show?
Well, I'm not a big band fan. You know, that band plays as well as any I've ever heard. You know, I'm just not. You know, more and more, I wonder what is it. You know, what is it for? You know, there are a couple of big band things that I do. Of course, Gil isn't a conventional big band at all. But I work with a guy in Europe named George Grunz, who's a Swiss piano player and arranger. And he has kind of a conventional big band, but his writing makes it a lot more palatable. And Peter Herbolzheimer, too, who's from Germany, is a greater. He's probably the best arranger in Europe. And so I like playing with those bands, but I think I'd fall asleep on the Tonight Show band. Yeah.
Are you glad that it's working?
Don't tell Doc I said that.
No. He's listening right now. He comes.
Oh, no. Is that him?
Are you glad that it worked out for you that you've been in so many different settings, you know, on TV and rock and jazz, on different instruments?
Well, yeah, I really did kind of set it up that way, though. I mean, I really figured I had to diversify. You know, I mean, if I had to do any one of the things that I do, I'd have starved long ago, you know. And and also, that way you stay out of the politics of things, you know. You stay out of the pecking order, you know. You know, I'm not in the studios enough, for instance, to really get into the scene where you have to watch what you say, and you know, it becomes so many social things other than just how you play. And I don't have to be in the rock scene, and I don't have to be in the jazz scene, and you know, and I can just kind of you know, do guerrilla warfare in the music business, you know.
Do you think that your work has inspired music students to learn tuba?
I don't really think so. First of all, they don't know what it is, you know. Like I said, I haven't been over-recorded as a soloist or as doing what I do. I've mostly recorded as what other people want. And so and on a lot of those things, you know, you don't even get in the mix properly, you know. I mean, it's, you know, some things I felt very good about in the studio, they come out and, you know, it's just not there. So I don't know if from tuba players that I talk to, they don't seem to be motivated to do what I do. No, I don't think that happens very much. Tuba, you have to remember, tuba is still, even though it's being played rather well now, there's still a profile of a tuba player's personality, you know, that is especially a classical tuba player, you know. He's not the guy who wants the challenge of, you know, the violin and, you know, I mean, you know, he'd rather have a little easier part. And you know, this is, of course, generalization. I'm not accusing the all tuba players of that. But most often, I mean, I get calls from time to time from people who say, well, look, I want to get into jazz on tuba. What should I do? You know, and I said, well, you know, you don't kind of get into jazz. You know, it's either in your life or it isn't. And if it is, I mean, you just kind of, you know, you kind of listen to it for one thing. You know, when I check out what those people are doing, they're not listening to jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've heard a Chuck Mangione record and they've heard a Pat Metheny record. And I say, listen to jazz, you know, listen to Chuck and Pat, but listen to everything, you know, and find out where you are in it. And they don't tend to be in touch with that the way a lot of, I mean, you know, you talk to saxophone players, trumpet players, and trombone players, keyboard players, and, you know, they're absorbing all this stuff from the music in a real personal way, you know, and something they want to do with it themselves. tuba players don't tend to have that kind of attitude. So when they ask me things like that, what they really want is for me to take them and show them how, you know. And I really think, I mean, see, there wasn't any jazz education when I came up, you know. There was maybe Berkeley. There was a place in California called Westlake School. But if you lived in Ohio, you know, and were 14 or something like that, you weren't going to any Berkeley. And I wasn't going to just do nothing until such time as I could get some instruction. Well, what did the people before any of that was happening do? You know, they listened to the music, they learned it, they found a way to learn it, you know. Then, I mean, you know, who gave Sonny Stitt lessons, you know? You know, I mean, this is just, I'm one of the reasons I don't do more clinics or any teaching is I'm kind of critical of those systems because they really put a lot of skills and tools into the hands of people who wouldn't have them if they didn't have that system to run to. See, and then all of a sudden you get these people showing up in New York and they're saying, well, I'm right because Dave Baker gave me straight A's at the University of Indiana, you know. And I said, well, gee, what am I doing then, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's – and so when I go around and do clinics, you know, I actually, you know – I don't know. I try to keep from suggesting that they're wasting their time in there, but I try to tell them to, you know, use all their resources, use what they can learn in that system and work themselves, you know. I mean, it's a 24-hour-a-day thing, you know. When I was trying to understand intervals in music well enough to learn to improvise by ear, I mean, everything was an interval to me, you know. I'd hear the, you know, a car horn or a doorbell, you know, I'd say, bing, bong, oops, minor third, there we go, you know. And, I mean, you know, I just had to be tuned to that in every way because there were no, I mean, I grew up in Ohio, right? There was nothing on the radio, maybe 2 hours a week of jazz on the radio. I didn't have a record collection or a record player, you know. I just kind of had to slide around to wherever the records were and listen to the little stuff that I could take off the radio and try to learn, you know. So I had to really absorb myself into it in a way that people don't tend to do if they have, you know, if they can just go to Berkeley, you know.
Well, I'm glad it's worked out as well as it has because I've enjoyed your music and I want to thank you very much for being here.
Okay, thank you.